My top five podcasters, Chris Lambert, and probably myself, but this ain't about that. The Mundane Festival is where you're at. If you've been tapped in, you know what's up. If you're a first timer, hey, welcome to the club. The cost of admission is simply a subscription, then rating and reviewing it wherever you listen. Don't worry about change ups, the cast won't break up. Even when that $1 million contract show up, a stand up guy who's a stand up comedian with a stance on everything from food to media. So welcome to the show, please take your seat. Let's find out what he's got in store this week. Who, me? I'm Don Will, your opening act. Thanks for coming out. Please clap. The Mundane Festival. With your host, Chris Lambert.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert, recording this episode for Sunday, July 24th, 2022. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast listening apparatus. If you're really into this thing, go over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you rate your podcasts. Give this show a 5-star review. Let everybody know why you like it, because it's simply the right thing to do. And if you want to take your love and appreciation of this show to an even deeper level, go over to patreon.com/mundanefestival. Subscribe $3 a month for hours and hours and hours of bonus content. This is episode 589. I have a super special return guest that I'm excited about. You should be excited about. You know her, you love her. It's Dr. Veronica Paredes. How you doing, Dr. P?
Chris, do they love me? Do you think they do?
They do.
You think so?
Yeah.
I mean, I really need people to love me, you know?
We all do. We all need that validation.
Please, listeners, please know and love me. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing okay. I'm excited to have you on to talk movies.
I'm excited to be here.
My thirst and hunger for our conversation is about to be satiated. I always get to touching base with you on stuff, and it's been a rough few months. But I don't know when you were on last. Maybe a few months ago. We talked about After Yang. So that was earlier.
Yeah.
We might have done one after that, but I know we did a letter. Go ahead.
We were going to maybe talk about men, but that didn't end up happening.
Yeah. Right. We just did it offline.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to remind me of that
it was a bit of time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited to talk about it with you. Because it's just so many layers. He's given us so much to talk about with this one.
Yeah. I want to do that. But like, as always, I like to know, like, first of all, how you're doing and what you've been watching. And then we'll just spoil Nope. And
sounds good.
See where we end up. And we'll talk about maybe what you're excited about coming up.
Upcoming. Okay. So, what I've been watching, I was thinking about this in preparation for talking with you. I've been watching Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
And I was like the first two episodes of The Return from the break. And that's been exciting. I was like floored by that season, that mid-season finale.
Yeah.
That was so good. It was so well done and well executed. So I was excited for that to return. And I don't know what's going to happen, you know? So it's kind of exciting in a storyline where you like already know what happens, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what's going to happen exactly.
I don't think I didn't want Kim to die, which I hope she doesn't.
Right.
She's
so good, man.
She's
like,
so great.
Did you watch the most recent episode?
I did. Yeah. I figured part of me felt like she was just going to leave him.
Yeah.
Because they're not good for each other.
They're not only not good for each other, they're not good for the world together.
Right.
Was her kind of sentiment, which is so good. And the way that she like manipulated the widow, Howard's widow, was like such a great scene. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been watching that. I've started watching For All Mankind. Did you know this one?
I've heard of it. Apple TV.
Yeah. It's like alternate history of NASA, the Apollo program, like what would happen if the Russians got there first. And I, you know, it was like the first couple of episodes, I wasn't really into it because I'm not really into alternate history type, you know, projects like that. But it's, you know, got a lot of really interesting actors, some really huge surprises. I was like pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoy the show. You know, because the Russians sent women to space so much earlier because of the competition that would have occurred if they got there first, the U.S. sent women to space a lot sooner in this timeline, and a black woman a lot sooner. And so it was just really interesting to see how they were trying to like bring it closer to like Star Trek kinds of idealism of what space travel could be. So that's been interesting. And then like, I've been rewatching sometimes Detroiters and Southside.
Oh my God.
Some comic relief.
So good. Things.
Yeah.
The two of the best comedies that have come out within the last 10 years.
I don't know how you watch Detroiters. So I had a Paramount Plus, subscription specifically for that. And then I stopped it. And I don't know why I restarted it for some reason. So I've got Detroiters again.
I bought Detroiters on
that makes sense.
YouTube, yeah. Like Google Play or something like, Google Play.
Oh, okay. I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah. So you can buy shows just like, I guess you can do, I'm assuming you can still do on iTunes. Yeah. I think you can do that. Cause actually did I buy it? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You can buy them.
So I rewatched the episode with the dad's birthday banquet.
Oh my God.
The clown.
Yeah. That show is so good. It's so good. Yeah. I think the that pilot. Kind of, I feel like that kind of paved the way for like, the South Side and Bust Down, you know, I think.
Oh yeah.
Those Midwestern, I don't know if you would call them Rust. You can't really call them Rust Belt, but just that Midwestern working class vibe.
Yeah, Bust Down is set in Gary, Indiana. I didn't realize.
Yeah.
I've only watched like maybe the pilot of that, and of course, I was rethinking about it because of the passing of Jack Knight.
Yes.
Recently.
Right.
Have you watched it?
I did. Yeah, it's very silly. It's silly in a good way. It's good. I liked it. I enjoyed it. It's like six episodes.
Okay. So it's pretty short. Yeah. I also was watching, what was it? Rutherford Falls, which is also Apple Plus. I was watching that for a little while.
Oh, okay. I've heard of it. I don't think I've seen it.
Yeah. That's with Ed Helms and, Jonna Schmendlin. It's you know, set on a reservation, or not a reservation, like a casino, and one of the main characters has like a cultural center within the casino. It's on Peacock.
That's one channel that I don't have, even though I saw somebody hooked me up with the screeners for Bust Down.
I see. Okay, I think I was confusing Peacock for Paramount. But yeah, that's a pretty good comedy. So, been watching that. I watched yesterday on PBS, through POV, a documentary that my friend had directed. That was really exciting. It was a documentary about Manzanar.
What's it called?
Manzanar Diverted. So Manzanar it's well known for being the location where Japanese Americans were interned. So it's Manzanar. And it's in the Owens Valley. It's in California. It's where they, and it's about the ways that water use in California intersects with that history. And so by that intersects with even like contemporary, recent day struggles with Native Americans being able to get access to water in that area, in that location. So that was really good. I would recommend people watch that. It's on demand. If you're, I don't know if it's everywhere, but the PBS station that I have. You could watch it on demand.
Gotcha.
So that was awesome. So what have you been watching?
Well, literally, right before we came on, I just finished watching Uma, the horror movie with oh my God, that is so bad. With Sandra Oh.
Oh yeah.
I'm gonna go ahead and give it three.
Oh, this is recent. This was a recent release.
I started watching it last night, but then I fell asleep. Not because the movie was bad, but
you're tired.
I was tired. It was late. And it was good. It was it's basically Sandra Oh's character is estranged from her mother, and her parents moved from Korea. The mother she was well respected in Korea, but then she moved to the US, and then she couldn't speak the language. And so she was kind of got bitter a little bit, and more than a little bit. Then her husband left. So it was just Sandra Oh's character and her mother. And then Sandra Oh just kind of ran away and basically started her own life. And she's got a kid living a quiet life on a farm, making honey, and kind of keeps her daughter under wraps, shelters her daughter. They can't have electronics in the house because Sandra Oh has that, like, I guess you call it like that psychosomatic thing that
the sensitivity
the,
like Charles, electronics, like Charles McGillhead,
yes, exactly.
Chuck McGillhead. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So they're dealing with that. And then her estranged uncle comes into town, brings her mother's remains and some of her prized possessions and dumps it off into the house, drops it off. And then the mother's spirit fucks with the relationship of her and her daughter, and they got to deal with that. And the daughter's about to go away to college, and it's pretty good. It's only like 88 minutes, you know. It's pretty good. It's a good performance from Sandra Oh, and you know, it's solid. You know,
is this a Korean American woman director, Iris Kashian?
Is she?
Let's see. House of Suh.
Probably. Let's see.
That's exciting. I haven't seen Sandra Oh in a horror.
Neither have I. I think this might be her first one.
Is that her daughter? In the key image in the target image at top of the letterboxed page.
Oh yeah, she's really pretty. I don't know.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, it's just like an image of a very beautiful woman. I expected like a 16-year-old, 17-year-old looking person.
Yeah, let me see how old she is, because I was gonna do my starlet age lookup.
Yeah.
Odea Rush, is that? No, that's not her. That is she played like a friend.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It might be. I don't think her name. Oh, is it okay? Fievel Stewart. Okay. She looks like she's of Native American descent.
25 years old, Chris.
Yeah.
Born in Beverly Hills. Okay. It's an interesting name, Fievel.
Like American Tail.
Yeah, like that little.
I wonder what her.
Is it a mouse?
Yeah, Fievel the mouse. Yeah. Somewhere.
Her mother is of Japanese, Korean, and Chinese ancestry, while her father is of Russian, Scottish, and Native American Blackfoot descent.
Yeah, she definitely looks like she could be on Reservation Dogs. Just like I think one of the actors is on, which is a terrific series that's coming out. Season 2 is coming out next month on Hulu.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, they got renewed. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
That's another one I've started, but haven't committed to watching the whole thing yet, Reservation Dogs.
Yeah, it's good.
It sounds like it was a pretty good horror film.
Yeah, it's just like a solid, you know what, horror version of Seeing Red, basically.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Overprotective mother dealing with her own shit and having to deal with her demons in order to get through her current situation. Solid.
Some hauntings. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that affliction or that's condition that you're describing. Have you seen Todd Haynes's Safe, starring Julianne Moore? It's from like the 90, it's from 90, let's see, what year is it? 95. I thought it was 95.
Is that it? Is that
yeah.
The one?
Yeah. And she develops, she's like a suburban, you know, housewife that starts to develop symptoms of this condition. And so it's all about that kind of her journey. It's a really interesting one. It features Southern California in interesting ways. I forget which suburb they live in. But it's interesting for that kind of, you know, it's rich for thinking about stories about like our specific, what we're doing to the environment, our technological condition, paranoia, is it mental or is it physical, you know, is it social, all those kinds of questions that came up. I did rewatch Better Call Saul from like episode one.
I need to
recently, well, you know, like leading up to this mid-season finale.
Sure.
And I do remember like the Chuck stuff being like so unpleasant when you see his perspective, right?
Yeah.
When you experience it through his kind of, and that Chuck storyline is tough, you know, and it's not funny. I mean, Chuck's not funny in any way, even though he's like he's a comedic actor, right?
Yeah. Michael McKean. Yeah.
Like well known for that.
Christopher Guest, one of his
guys, the Spinal Tap. Yeah. Yeah. But that he is such a tough character, man. And, if there is humor, it's like really dark. It's like really, like, you know, not slapstick.
And no, not,
like,
no, not at all.
On the surface at all. It's really deep and kind of tough humor. Ironic and cynical.
What's your take on, I mean, people will naturally do this, and I've kind of been hearing the rumblings. Better Call Saul, is it better than Breaking Bad? Is it on par? What do you think? What are your thoughts?
For my money, I like it more. It's better. You know, I enjoy Better Call Saul a lot more. And, you know, I've heard you talk about this. Yeah, it does have a lot of, like, mythology and backstory that's already built that it's able to step right into. Mm-hmm. But I remember, you know, watching Breaking Bad season one. I was just thinking, oh God, this is like really racist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh shit. How so? Explain.
Well, remember like Tuco's character. He's just inscrutable and like just crazy. And then there's Crazy Eight. And it's just like, and then there's these white guys, which, you know, is the case here too. It just took people so long to realize how much of a villain Walter White was.
Oh yeah.
And I like hated him from like, you know, from jump, from like step one.
Oh, you did? You hated him from the rip. Okay.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like when he's in the pilot, when he's in his underwear, his tidy whities in like the middle of the desert, I'm like everything about him, you know, just, and you know, it, I don't know, maybe it's like hindsight because I know what he becomes and the kind of, I rewatched scenes from that too. When I was really into the Better Call Saul, like deep dive and rewatched the scenes where he goes and like the ending episodes, right.
Yeah.
Where he goes to this like billionaire friend that he started with and manipulates them. Yeah. And like just the entitlement and the fact that that's the thing that brings him back from the brink, right. Is vengeance and like the kind of like festering resentment that he has against them. That's what brings him back into actually making a plan.
They screwed him over, but like,
yeah, I'm but a lot of people get screwed over.
I'm just hoping my thing is I would just want the money to go, that money to really go to his family though.
But I love that. It's like, it doesn't matter. He screwed them up. Like when he talks to,
his son
Junior, Finn, right.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, what? We don't care about the money. We hate you. I hate you.
Yeah.
You know, what you've done.
You're going to need that money though, dog.
Yeah. But I don't know, dude. Like, it does like interrogate that myth that we have. Like, I think a lot of people will like, I've been thinking about this because I've been dealing with time management and some people, I remember when I was in grad school, people were like, this is a fantasy. This is not even, maybe even people said this, maybe it's a straw man thing, but like, if you have a kid, you really learn to use your time because you have no other choice. Right. Mm-hmm. And if you have a kid, you have to succeed. You have to get money. You have to attain all these things in order for them to be okay. And I've just been thinking about this, and it's fake, right? I mean, it's like the idea that we would only be able to be upward and that the next generation is always going to be better off than us. Sometimes, like, it's just not going to happen. And I think that we're seeing that happen right now, you know? Like, it's just like my family, my parents, they were able to succeed economically, financially, move from like working class into like what we consider middle class.
Yeah.
Now, but you know, like if you have kids now and you have a house and all those things, it's not the same opportunities. It's, and to have that expectation, that promise that you're supposed to move up is like detrimental and like actually hurts your prospects of enjoying the present life that you do have, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think about that a lot. I think they were saying like our generation or the generation behind it. Cause now I saw a thing that said I'm Generation X. Cause I was born in 1980.
Mm, you're on the cusp just like me. I was 82. So I was like,
So it's like, it's saying I'm Generation X, and maybe our generation, my generation, this or millennials, were the first that didn't get what was promised to them, I guess, to a certain degree, because of like the financial crisis in 08 and all this stuff. But I mean, I grew up like, I mean, I kind of grew up not expecting things, but just saying like, if you do prepare yourself, if you get an education, you have better opportunities. So I think that's the thing that my parents, you know, sacrifice for.
Right.
And So I think that's one of the things. But yeah, I never felt like anything was promised to me, you know, just because. Yeah, I never felt that. I know.
Well, I think it is also, sorry.
No, go ahead.
It's like a specifically white American story too, like the Walter White story.
Oh,
right?
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have been thinking about this in relation to California because I'm preparing for this. I'm teaching a class in the fall called Screening Los Angeles. Mm. And I've been reading some the Joan Didion book, Where I Was From.
Okay.
And she's revisiting all of those like frontier myths about California. And I think that in California, it's interesting because I think even like Black Americans and, you know, people of color, Japanese Americans during World War II, like there was like these myths or ideas about California that were quickly corrected, you know, about how successful you could be in this like land of golden, you know, this golden land kind of promise of California. Yeah.
Are you going to show them Lady Bird?
You know, I have to consider this. Would you recommend it?
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it, Chris.
Oh, I would say you see it and make your determination.
Is Sacramento? Is it Northern California or Central California?
She is from, where is that character from? It is Northern Cali. Is it where are they trying to get out of? I forget. But Joan Didion is quoted. That's why.
Oh, I see. Sacramento. Yeah, it's set in Sacramento. Yeah, of course. Yeah, she was born in Sacramento.
Show them Lady Bird. Show them Collateral.
They asked me, I was considering Collateral. They asked me to include Lady Bird instead of All Real Women Have Curves. They were like, in one of my evaluations, they were like, you should show more recent films because so we can be interested in Real Women Have Curves is too old, apparently. How Lady old Bird would be a better. It's like, you know, was it 2002?
Almost just 20 years ago, but I mean, that's not that. It's been a long time since I've seen it. I remember liking it.
That's like a quintessential, like that's Los Angeles. They're in Los Angeles. You know, it's very much dialogue with like, anyway, but that wasn't an LA class, but.
What about Sucker Free City?
Oh, tell me about that? This one.
Mm-mm. It's a Spike Lee flick, came out in 2004. It was supposed to be it's like a Showtime movie. And it says, a white mailroom clerk who rips off his coworker's credit card numbers on the side moves to a mostly African-American neighborhood and is terrorized by a local gang called the V-Dubs. He befriends K-Love, a black gang member whom Nick helps sell bootleg CDs, and they soon build a relationship with Lincoln, a low-level Chinese gangster, but tension becomes palpable as the trio begin committing crimes. I think it's worth seeing, but I don't know if you could play that for your class, but like, it's kind of like Medicine for Melancholy does.
I'm definitely going to watch it because I definitely want to give them like lots of options on things they might write about too.
I'm trying to think because Medicine for Melancholy, Last Black Man in San Francisco, like Sucker Free City are like interesting movies about San Francisco, and it does talk about that melting pot and the different, talks about class a little bit, but you're going to get a little, it's going to be a little more I would just say, you know, you should see it and you decide, but like Lady Bird is Sacramento.
Yeah, I think this has got me thinking, reading Didion, it's got me thinking maybe I'd like to teach like a California class in the future. Yeah. And this one's screening Los Angeles, and it's specifically, but it is thinking about interrelation, like the relationships with other areas. So even like that Manzanar documentary was interesting because we take the water from Owens Valley, right? Mm-hmm. So there are connections between Los Angeles and these other, and LADWP owns land over there. It's kind of interesting. So, you know, that would be like the Chinatown kind of inclusion. Mm-hmm. But I have on my Letterboxd when we transitioned into that, I did watch Destroyer.
I saw that. Yeah. What'd you think?
Have you seen that? Oh, I liked it a lot. Yeah, me too. It's a film noir. So the other thing is it's the genre class, but I feel this kind of responsibility to like also teach the students about genre films. So I'm focusing on film noir, science fiction, and then social realism in the class. So this is a nice one for film noir. Because I was thinking about Collateral, which is a great LA film, but I had been looking for something that was, you know, directed by a woman and had a woman protagonist to really think about the femme fatale.
Now you got me thinking of stuff.
You know, Brick is also set in LA, and I haven't rewatched that one yet.
Yeah, you know what?
Yeah.
What is that, 06?
Isn't that crazy?
Brick, I love that movie.
It's been so long. Yeah. Can you imagine? So we're almost like 20 years out from, you know, it's.
Yeah. When you can say that was 20 years ago and remember it vividly.
So weird.
I remember getting this because I didn't see a lot of these movies. I didn't see in the theater. Like I would have to get them on DVD because, you know, even though I was living in, well, when I was an undergrad, we were in the middle of nowhere. We were within 2 hours from DC, but on my breaks and stuff, like my dad and I went to see The Virgin Suicides. And
did your dad like it?
He did. I think he was my, cause he knew DC cause he had, you know, so he would take me, DC can be confusing. So we'd go to see stuff like that.
It was a Detroit film.
Yes. I read the book and I had to, so that was like 2000, something like that. And he and I went to see that. Brick, you know, because even though we were close to DC, I mean, my school was 2 hours away, but I wasn't going out like that all the way into DC to see that movie. But it was, I'd have to wait till they came to the video store, till they came on DVD. And when I was in grad school, and living in Chicago, there was this place called LA Tan and Video, and you could get it. It was run by it was run by this Indian guy, and it was in what they call Boys Town. Mm-hmm. And, it was walking distance from me, like a less than a 3 minute walk, something like that. And the guy would put the movies on hold for me and I would buy them, you know? So Brick, that's I think I have a copy within my copy within reach.
It's funny. Okay. Chris is leaning over. He's going to pull out a copy of Brick. Brick's Right there. Right there. Wow. There it is.
And I think I got it. I got it from him. Yeah.
That's funny.
Really good movie.
It was like $60 at the time. What do you think?
How much were DVDs? Paying?
Yeah.
Oh, probably like I had a tab. I know that. I know I had a tab. Probably like $20 or it wasn't that much.
It was. When did that? Did you see that store close down?
It did close. It didn't. It did not close down before I left. But I don't know. I doubt if it's still there.
I was going to mention thinking about Chicago. I also watched Bear. I wonder if you watch that.
There?
The TV show Bear, B-E-A-R.
Oh God, yeah, I was raving over that. I think it's a fantastic show. It's like now because they released every episode all at once, the first season all at once. People are now starting to get to it, and I thought it was terrific. I think you know, Ayo,
Edebiri, she's Ayo, so good.
She's
I've been
fantastic.
Knowing about her. I mean, I've seen her do comedy.
Yeah.
Out here, and I think in New York too, maybe anyway. And she's frequently on that Hollywood Handbook podcast.
Oh, I don't know what that is. Maybe I'll check that out.
It's an improv. It's Hayes Davenport and Sean Clements. And they do this whole shtick where it's like insider's view of Hollywood, but you know, it's kind of a
she was on there 3 weeks ago.
A joke. But she's really funny on there. I had watched Shameless too, a few seasons of, or at least one season.
I had to bail on it.
It
got a little too weird towards the end, but I did like it and I like that guy. But it's definitely, you know, like I was telling you guys when we did our Oscar preview and everything like that, you know, gave our best movies. Boiling Point was one of my favorites of last year about these chefs at a restaurant,
right.
You know, in London. And it's something about that, like the working on a craft, trying to get better and working as a team, working as a family. And I think
it's a volatile environment. My God, it's so good for storytelling.
Yeah. And I think Ayo is a star. I haven't seen her in Dickinson, but she's great. She's really good.
She's so funny. She's so charismatic.
Yeah.
She's so pretty.
Yeah, she is really pretty too. You know.
Yeah, but what was I going to say about that? Oh, this episode, you've seen all of Bear then, the one shot episode, I thought of you too, because it was basically like one movement and it was like one episode that was like 18 minutes long. I was like, whoa, this is bold. This is like, so, you know, this is really, you know, swinging for the fences. Like this is a really interesting experimentation with the form. What they've done with that episode. It was such a good episode. I think it was like episode 8 or 9.
I might go back and rewatch.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, that's what we've been watching. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get into Nope. Let's get into Nope.
Do it.
Let's see. I could do the.
You have more Letterboxd you want to get to, or you want to just, you're going to get to Nope. We're going to do Nope.
Does Letterboxd have a blurb on Letterboxd? Nah, that's pretty.
That's not a great one.
That's not a great one. Let's see what Google says. Google, let's see. All right.
Oh, yeah, I like this one.
Okay, let's do this one. Let's read the Google blurb. Two siblings who run a California horse ranch discover something wonderful and sinister in the skies above, while the owner of an adjacent theme park tries to profit from the mysterious otherworldly phenomenon. Nope is written and directed by Jordan Peele. Veronica, what are your thoughts on this movie? Your overall thoughts on this one?
I'm into it, Chris. I really want to rewatch it. I thought that it was like, it brought up so many bits and kinds of like references for a film nerd that are really exciting to like mull over for a few days. And it was, I don't know, masterful. It's just like really exciting to see Jordan Peele like branch out in these ways and really not like continue to do the same thing that he knows is going to work. But really try to like try something new in genre. It seems like it's all kind of building too, like, you know, with the Twilight Zone into this, it feels like the kind of natural progression of like where he's going with his storytelling. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not flawless. Of course, there are like things that I think are underdeveloped or I would have liked to spend more time with. But overall, yeah. I just thought it was so good, so interesting, so well acted, so you know, thoughtfully engaging with this idea of spectacle. Yes. And human nature. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed it. I mean, I remember after watching Us thinking, oh, well, this is quite different than mm-hmm. Get Out, you know, and it's got a lot of ideas and it feels a little unwieldy, but it's great. But I don't know, something about this one really is really compelling to me. What'd you think?
I agree with you. I feel, and the more I think about it, and I have a couple people, my buddies, like even our friend Jeff Cerulli said, the more he thinks about it, the more he likes it. I think this is Jordan Peele's version of Spike Lee's She Hate Me.
I saw you write that in Letterboxd. What do you mean by that?
So She Hate Me was a film that was all over the place. Now, granted, it's way more of an art house film than Nope, but it's like it's kind of sprawl, it's a little bit all over the place. Spike definitely has access to grind. There's themes that he wants to, you know, put out there, and it's very entertaining. You know what I mean? And I found that, I mean, because we're spoiling this, folks, so if you haven't seen this film, you know, you can stop it, watch the film, come back. Some of the shit that he kind of leaves on the table a little bit, like this, the Gordy thing.
Yeah.
That's some of the most sinister, crazy shit I've ever seen in that genre. I was like, are you kidding me? And it was almost like this, you know, when Ricky takes them into that little room, it reminded me of Atlanta, reminded me of that Teddy Perkins episode.
Oh yeah, that's an interesting parallel.
And then they kind of go back and they go back and show you what happened. And it was just, that to me was the most fascinating thing in the whole film. And you're just gonna it's rich in so many things, like, okay, the way you treat animals, the way Hollywood is this monster that can suck you up and then spit you out when it's done with you. If it can't digest you, it'll spit you out. There's the thing of legacy where Otis wanted to maintain his father's business. What they do to Black people in the business, the way they're treated, and really mm-hmm. the way they treat everybody. It's really indiscriminate, but then because it's an American industry, it's going to treat you just like other industries treat people of color. So that's almost a given. It's a fascinating thing, because it's like the spectacle. If you don't pay attention to it, then you'll get through, you know, then there's a way. Did you feel like I don't feel like he died at the end, Daniel Kaluuya. Who?
Oh no, for sure. He's victorious.
Yeah. Right. Cause there were some of the nerds on YouTube were saying that it's possible that he might've died cause he was under that sign that said out yonder or whatever.
I mean, that's interesting. No, but I think it is like what they are interpreting there. It is symbolic. Mm-hmm. Like he is the Western hero, right?
Yeah.
It's totally engaged with science fiction, aliens versus cowboys kinds of things that we've been seeing in reviews. Mm-hmm. It's in those genres, the genre meld between those two.
Yeah.
And so, you know, him as the kind of Black cowboy, the victorious, the hero that survives, it's more symbolic. His whole character, right? The way when he's not interacting with Emerald, and he's not interacting with his sister, is like totally stoic, kind of like almost Clint Eastwood type character. And then you have like the good and the bad and the ugly soundtrack kind of thing that comes in, the Morricone song at the end, right? Is it good and bad? I didn't look it up, but it's like very much like quintessential canonical Western song that plays at the end of the film. And then it's got the image of him there, you know? So I can see how people would misinterpret that as like him being dead, because it's definitely him being symbolic or symbolized, right? As something larger than the character.
Yeah. And I didn't see it that way. Yeah. I didn't see him dying, but I was like, no, he didn't die. Cause he's the one that tells him not to look at the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Cause I want to see this again, because he was doing the cowboy thing. He gave them, Jordan Peele in interviews was saying that he gave them a list of movies and No Country for Old Men was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about it. I was like, yeah, cause he's a cowboy. OJ is a cowboy. And because of that, he did mumble a lot. So I'm kind of like, what did he think? And then the thing that kind of pissed me off about, not about the movie, but just my experience was, I had this gig in Red Bank and the theater had it playing in IMAX at an old mall. And it was in Monmouth County. It was at the AMC Monmouth Mall. And the movie wouldn't start. After Nicole Kidman comes on, the movie the whole screen just went black.
Oh,
and so I was, and people were just sitting there. I gave it a minute and I was like, I'm going out there. I'm going to tell them
what the hell?
To start this fucking movie. And because people were just sitting there.
Yeah.
And it was a fake IMAX. It was that Limax. It was not.
You said it doesn't meet the measurements or what was
it? No, it's just not. Like, it didn't even seem like it was one that would be in a relatively new theater. Like even the one near me, even at the Garden State Mall, where it was not, it didn't seem that big.
You know?
I mean, the last film I saw in IMAX was The Eternals, I think. And it wasn't that, and that theater was a bigger theater, but I think the next time I see it, it'll be in Dolby. But I was just kind of, and I think the sound was kind of off in that theater too.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So that was, it didn't really take anything that much from my experience, because I did enjoy the movie, but there's certain things I feel like I might have missed, you know?
Yeah.
But I really, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say that I visited this AMC theater because I had mentioned to you that our Landmark Theater is closed down, which is very sad. I'm very sad about the passing of this theater that was like my neighborhood theater. But anyway, I went to this AMC Mall theater, and I'd seen a movie at this theater before. And I think I was near the IMAX theater because it was so much sound leakage. Like, it was so unenjoyable. It was awful.
Yeah.
You know? But I feel like I was sitting right where the sound coming from. So I was like, okay, well, at least now I can enjoy this in a way. Like, why, if I'm going to watch a movie at that theater, it's going to be IMAX, because that's kind of like, I think, the best theater in that complex. So I got to have the good experience because it wasn't sound leakage, but I was probably causing sound leakage in the nearest theater to us.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Because he did shoot it in IMAX. One of my friends asked me, should he see it in IMAX? I said, it's not a necessity, but if you can see it, just see it in a good theater. See it in like I think if I go across the highway to Hackensack 9, like the AMC Dine-In, it'll be fine, you know?
Yeah. Crimes of the Future I'd seen with all that sound leakage, actually, that Cronenberg film.
Oh, yeah. We didn't.
Yeah,
we didn't talk about that.
We texted about it.
Yeah.
That's not a good one to have sound leakage in, because there are some kinds of like quiet parts. It's not like you kind of need a nice theater for that one too. I mean, you need a nice theater for any movie, right?
Right, right. Go ahead.
No.
What'd you think about the pacing?
Of Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one thing that I was like, there are certain things that I really loved about like the Steven Yeun, the Ricky character.
Yeah.
But the kind of like, I loved that scene, actually. Like, you're right. The one where he kind of goes, shows them the room behind his official office, and the way he relays that kind of SNL sketch is so well done. I thought that was so well written. The way he's like, Chris Kattan, just like, he goes, like, he just, what does he say? He kills him.
Yeah.
And it was like obvious, like there's so much else going on underneath that we see in the Gordy, you know, chapter.
Yeah.
But I thought the way that he spoke about that trauma in that kind of way was really well done. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the pacing, I don't know if it was actually, I was going to mention that, you know, I felt like, could have used more time with Ricky to figure out what's going on with that amusement park.
I wanted more time because he was so, it was almost like he was this so compelling that to me was one of the most compelling characters. The hero, OJ, I mean, everybody likes Daniel Kaluuya. He's great.
Yeah.
Keke Palmer's charming as fuck, you know, whatever. Yeah. But it's like the cowboy's not going to be that interesting. The sister, the sidekick, okay, funny. And she's a good actress. But then the Steven Yeun is just like, I mean, come on.
We got so little and it was so much, right? Like when the wardrobe for him, I wrote down something about, you know, when he turns around during that spectacle, that moment where he's able to have the audience, and it's a really bare audience, right?
That's
kind of interesting. Like, why were there such few people there? And then he turns around, he's got this like jacket with the embroidered image of like roses or flowers rather, and the like saucer in the middle.
Yeah.
Like, how did they, what is leading up to this? How did they know about this? When did they learn about this? I was going to mention his wife is played by someone in For All Mankind, his wife, Amber, something or other. Anyway, it seemed like, what were you saying?
I was going to say, it seems like that took place for over 6 months or so.
And that's so what we get, the dad dies. And I think it's been 6 months since the dad died.
I didn't understand. I think there's a title card or something that says 6 months. And OJ's been selling the horses off to Ricky so he could feed those horses to the
I got to that too. To the creature in the sky.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really sad. And also, like, you know, I do like that it's like, it's elliptical. It doesn't give you much. It doesn't spell things out. And you kind of just have to figure out that the hesitation that Ricky's giving him about like, I'll sell them back is like probably not going to happen because they've been maybe consumed by this creature. And you also get this sense that maybe it was before the dad died, because how would he have summoned that creature? Did he summon the creature, or was the creature just there?
I don't think he summoned it, but I think that, you know, that he thought that he could control.
Right. That's the main kind of point.
Because of Gordy.
Yeah.
And Gordy, an animal's going to be an animal. You know, like he's going to be an animal. But since they had that relationship of doing the dap, the fist bump, then that was so fucking fascinating.
A kinship. Yeah.
That might be the best fucking piece of work that he's, I mean, just the way that played out. It's so sad. And he hasn't even really gotten therapy. I mean, he hasn't really dealt with that. The way he explains that story, like you're telling that monologue, you could have died.
Yeah. Yeah. And he definitely suffered trauma. And the thing is, like, you know, as the performer, you just like say you work it out through the kind of representation that you saw in SNL. And then, you know, this like when he's actually having the spectacle to have the creature come, you know, he talks about his co-star and how he had a crush on her, his first crush. Right. So it's always like nicely, neatly tied kind of bow of like, this is fine. This is fine.
And it's supposed to be, I guess, like a play on Holes, which was his big movie that he did when he was young. Mm-hmm. And they always say, what happened to the black when Keke Palmer, Emerald says, oh, what happened to the black kid?
I like that
movie you were in. And I guess they're talking about Cleo Thomas, because Cleo did have a run where he was killing it.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So it's like, oh, what happened to that black kid that was. And then it kind of tapered off, I guess, after that show, because he was known for the show, because the show only did like two seasons after the monkey spazzed out. And so he was really known for that show, Jupiter's thing. What is it? Jupiter's claim.
Cove? No, claim. Claim. Yeah.
It's so good. Like, I don't know. Like, let's talk about this. Where do you think this ranks in his three films?
It's really hard to Get Out is such a good film. It's like a watch. He has spent so much time putting that together, writing that script. That's such a good film.
That's his Illmatic.
Yeah. I like it more than Us.
Okay. See, I'm trying to think about it. I told Randolph last night, I was like, I'm not going to say anything to you about it till you see it. But I just kind of felt like, man, is that Get Out was kind of like, I saw that because I was just like, I was going to see it regardless. And they're like, from Jordan Peele. And I didn't think anything of it. But then when I saw it, I was like, oh my God, is this good? Yeah. And when I saw people getting mad, I saw like white people get mad. I was like, ooh.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was just like, I was like, this is really good. And I just thought this was a good movie. It was funny. It kind of reminded me of just like a disturbing behavior with
which one? This Nope did. Nope was no, this
us.
For
us.
You?
I us. Mean, oh. Get Out. Get Out did.
Oh, okay.
Get Out was like, but with the racial racial over and undertones to it. Us to me was anchored by that terrific Lupita Nyong'o performance.
Yeah. Unbeatable. Like that's a really good performance. She's the center of that film, obviously. And yeah, I even hesitate because her performance is so good in that.
So it's just kind of like, and they're all so different, which is, so I kind of have to, I guess I would have to think about it more, but I mean, that's what we do when we talk about these films and you talk about a director and they're all really good, but it's just, man, I just think it's something. And then we bring our own baggage to stuff too. So
it's just, this is like more, Nope is very sweeping, right? Yeah. Like I feel like Us is very much in like this time of the 80s of when that happens, when the switch happens in Us. Mm-hmm. Like it's about the horror films that are about underclass. Like, it's very much about like that kind of theme. And I think that's great. And it's pretty, but it also shows that he's got these kinds of auteurist, branching out. He's already starting to branch out in Us and become more sweeping. This is huge. This is a huge film,
It's funny because this is the most money he's, I think, because they're really pushing it out because Universal, like he's doing these like interviews and he's on, Today Show is NBC, right? Like they're really, it's Universal. So they're really pushing it. And, it's like, where was I going with that? Oh, shit. I forgot where I was going.
I mean, do you remember like watching Independence Day in the theater? The Will Smith film?
You know what? I don't know if I saw that in the theater.
Let's see. What year was that?
94, 95, 96?
Yeah. Around then. I was thinking about that. These kinds of films. This is on like par of like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm-hmm. This is Spielberg, man. This is like huge. Oh, it's 96.
I know what I was going to say. He was doing, out of tons of interviews I watched that he did after I saw the movie and the prep for this, it might have been on Seth Meyers. I think it was on Seth Meyers or Tonight Show, one of them. But he said, it's not a movie. And he was like, he had to stop himself. He's like, it's a concept. And it is, because it's almost like, because of all those themes that he's introducing to us, and it's like he just kind of was just kind of throwing it out there. And shout out to my man Tim Hall, aka the People's Critic. He was saying that one of his friends called it Jaws in space, Jaws in, and I thought that was funny, but it's still kind of true. But it's like he's dealing with all these themes, and it's like it's a hodgepodge of all these things. But then it's entertaining. I didn't really care about the time. I noticed it, but it didn't take anything away from me. You know what I mean?
I mean, that's not going to be an issue. And like for us, I think, like I watched Drive My Car and didn't feel that at all. It's just not going to be an issue. And I don't, there's like something compelling and something interesting that someone has to say through a film, I'm going to stick around to watch it. You know, it's that doesn't, I don't care about that. what I think that him saying about it's a concept that makes a lot of sense in like, and he's completely reworking the idea of a movie as not only like a feature film, but like it's a ride. It's merchandise. It's a franchise. It's potentially sequels. That's what Westerns always do, right? That's what science fiction films always do. Like, and to do that and think about it and to have such like a kind of critical kind of message underneath all that around exploitation of animals, exploitation of children, exploitation of, you know, people of color within the industry, all those kinds of things underneath it into this kind of big blockbuster concept. I don't know, man. It's like, I wouldn't want anybody else to have that kind of power than Jordan Peele. And the way that he's commenting, you know, I realize that the TMZ, he's still got these kinds of intellectual things going on. The TMZ reporter's name, last name is Muybridge. I realized looking at the credits, it's like okay
is Jordan. That the guy that runs TMZ?
Well, Edward Muybridge, this is the guy who started Moving Image. This is the thing that he talked about in the beginning with the horse that we were looking at the Wikipedia page for it, and I was watching that gif of the horse that's a bet between Edward Muybridge and Stanford to see whether or not a horse's legs, you know, ever are completely off the ground. And to prove that with Moving Image, that's the same kind of technique that was used in The Matrix for bullet time, this kind of way of like physical cameras installed, thinking about the history of filmmaking, basically, and gesturing to it and that, connecting folks, that to social media.
And that, folks, is why I love having Veronica on the podcast. You see what I'm talking about? There you go. The more I talk about this shit, I think, man, I might have to give it another star, because it's like, I don't know.
He's so smart.
That fucking prologue into the Gordy shit was like, what the fuck? Because I didn't want to see, this is the first movie in a long time, possibly in quite some time, where I was like, okay, he's got a new movie out. They've shown a trailer. I've seen those little trailers. I'm done. I'm not going to look at anything else, because, you know, I think for the past, maybe the past year, I'm like been looking at stuff and just saying like, I like when people take big swings. I like when people take big swings. They're ambitious. The work is original. And yes, you know, you're playing on the Close Encounters. You obviously, Spielberg's an influence and all these things. You can't, that's undeniable. But it's like when you're trying to do something original, and this is what he's doing. And I just, it's something about like that. Oh, I don't know. Something about that child actor thing. Because I was like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. Do you know that was based on like a real thing that happened with, not on set, but a chimpanzee that chewed a woman's like face off, basically.
Well, I was assuming was it, because I didn't know about the TV, a TV thing, but the woman who had her friend, the chimp.
Yeah, like, the Travis the chimp. Yeah.
I kind of was, it's not surprising that it was based on that, because she actually lived.
Right. And they got a face transplant. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It was, and the kind of like the eyes on that, right? Like the fascination, the human fascination about what happens afterward. Right. Yeah. It's like more like the spectacle of like what on the physical face is different, where the scarring and all that stuff is within the Steven Yeun character. It's just not as readily visible, right? Mm-hmm. But all that kind of like disfigurement, whatever. I mean, I do feel a little kind of weird. I've been thinking about like the ways disfigurement is used in horror films and how like that could be interpreted as like, you know, obviously ableist to use these kinds of images or people with disabilities or disfigurements as like horror, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't like the way that was played up in the trailer. I don't think it was that like that in the film.
No, you know? it's because a lot of people were making these assumptions about that film was about this. I don't know if this, I think there was like a Vanity Fair thing where they had some of the cast And I didn't look at the video yet, but it was NOPE is supposed to stand for not of planet Earth.
Right.
But really, like when Jordan Peele was describing, he's like, that's what black people are going to say when they see that the creature. Nope. Like,
yeah, that's engaged.
Yeah. I think it's just simply that. I don't know if that's confirmed that not of planet Earth is what they mean. Yeah. Maybe that's another maybe it is an acronym. I don't know.
Well, it's the same kind of thing with like, what was it? What was the movie that gets referenced in Us? It's like the horror film that people living below the city, it's like a glum or something, or it's like a four letter word. It stands for something. It's like chum, the S-C-H-U-M or something.
I don't remember.
Chud. C-H-U-D. And anyway, that kind of reminds me when you're talking about that. It's 1984.
Oh, okay.
It reminds me of that kind of like, I think it's kind of tongue in cheek, not of planet Earth, that kind of thing. Cause you know, his original like working title for the film was something like Little Green Men. Right. And it's kind of satirical. It's like, you know, there are no little green men, but it's kind of like, this is a genre film that's going to engage with that, but then also go much deeper and kind of subvert those expectations, right?
Yeah.
So the NOPE thing is like, what's fascinating, he's like, he goes from that, like, okay, that kind of joke about black people's reactions to horror films, and then goes even further of like, okay, what if we said NOPE to the spectacle, or what if we said no to that, but are still engaged in it? Like, you're still sitting in the theater, even though you're saying NOPE, right? So like, you're sitting in the theater with like your hands over your eyes or something, but you're still in the theater, you're still at the spectacle, so you're still kind of participating in it.
Right.
So that kind of like double contradictory paradoxical positioning is like what he's exploring and having a blockbuster where you're not supposed to look up, you know?
Right.
So like, that's that whole, the whole subversion or kind of like contrasting with the Spielberg face kind of thing that Kevin B. Lee had that video essay about, and I think has been written about, you know, the face looking up in awe from Close Encounters of the Third Kind, especially. And of course, you know, if you do that in NOPE, that's what Steven Yeun's character does. You're going to get swallowed up.
Right.
And so the defense mechanism of like that as a method or a tactic to what Daniel Kaluuya's character does, or OJ does when he's in the truck in submerged in darkness, he looks up and then immediately it's NOPE and looks down. Right.
Yeah.
Like that kind of thing. The fact that he's playing that and then putting it to a larger thing of like, I'm going to be a blockbuster filmmaker and then also subvert these things. Think about the history of filmmaking, think about moving image in these kinds of critical ways and connect it to the saturation, media saturation of TMC.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just like, he's exploring these really, like you said, ambitious, big things, big themes.
Can you speak on like the fact that nobody was at Jupiter's Claim for that? Like, because is it just like you mentioned, the oversaturation of spectacle,
right?
That nobody kind of gave a shit when stuff was really going down.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I've been thinking about that because, you know, he invites them with like a flyer instead of like a tweet or something, or instead of like a text message, which is interesting. I was also thinking of like, you know, Ricky as like this Asian American kid that's in this like white family.
Yes.
In that show. Mm-hmm. And then also like this white wife, and you know, most all the people in that audience seem to be just like people that happen to live in like proximity, white people that happen to live in the desert, you know, that were like loyal kinds of goers, like visitors to the park. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem like it was something that he was like, even if it is spectacle, it's not like he was translating that into social media spectacle, right? Because that would imagine you would get a lot more visitors or people visiting then. And also just like, he just seems like this kind of like Asian American child, this child actor, but also that he's Asian American in this adopted family. We don't even know like what his real family is like. We see this TV family. He has like, you know, I just was thinking about the whiteness of the people that were surrounding him.
Oh, now that you mention it, somebody said on like Looper or some shit or something, like Goonies, the kid that became the husband and
everything everywhere all at once.
Yeah. Did we talk about that?
Yeah.
Okay.
He talked about that movie.
Yeah,
that's what we talked about last movie.
About his career.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to make that comparison. That's who he, to a certain degree, was. Mm. Oh my God. Ki-Hu Kwan.
Yeah.
Because he was in Indiana Jones and.
Yeah, he was a child actor and then dropped from the industry and worked in, well, not the industry because he was still working in like stunts, but didn't want to be an actor anymore because of the roles that he was going in were really caricatured and terrible. So, yeah, I think that, you know, I don't know about that connection other than they're both like Asian American child actors.
But continue on your point. If I hope I didn't derail you too much, but you just
know, I don't. It's kind of underdeveloped. I'm not really sure what to do with it. You know, just the fact that he is surrounded by white people and we don't see like the presence. I don't remember of like parents that are Asian American.
No.
And so, you know, like that kind of, you know, he's also an Asian American cowboy, which is kind of strange. Right.
Right.
So thinking about that, that's why I mean, like, I think some things were left unresolved with that character.
Yeah.
I would have liked to have seen a little bit more.
And I agree, because it's like maybe that's the point. Like he wants us to want more because it was so beautifully put together where it's like, well, fuck, I want to know about that kid. I want to know, like, and maybe that, you know, sometimes that's all you get and you can speculate. But like, it was almost like, cause there's a little bit of that, like maybe like that Shia LaBeouf in a lot of ways too, but Shia continued to have a successful career that he was the cause of anything that really went left when it just his behavior.
Right.
Cause he's a real, I think he's a real talented guy.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the other thing that comes up around the child actors, you know, Ricky tries to bring his kids out, who the ones who try to prank OJ.
Yes.
Right. But and then he tries to say, you know, don't forget them, like remember them, and, like potentially trying to like continue the legacy of child acting.
Yeah.
For his performers, at least for his kids.
You know why this? I'm going to stop you here and I want you to. Maybe you can dissect this. The reason why the Gordy thing fascinated me so much was because I guess when I was a kid, I wanted to do that. I wanted to be I wanted to be like a childhood actor or whatever. And it's funny because one of my inspirations when I was a kid was this actor named Jason Weaver, who played Michael Jackson in the Jackson Story. He was on Thea, smart guy. He had a music career. He was really cool and his career just kind of stalled. I think he stopped it because the music industry is so brutal. I think I've heard him talk about that in podcasts and stuff. He's on this show now called The Shy on Showtime. And I was watching this scene where his character was like, just got out of prison his character gets out of prison trying to turn his life around. There's a scene in one of the most recent episode where he's sitting at this restaurant that everybody, the whole neighborhood goes to. This street kid comes in and tries to rob the restaurant. And Jason Weaver's character stops him and sits the kid down and gives him something to eat. And it was just like, man, that's like some full circle shit. Like it was, you just made me think of this now that we're talking about it, but like, he's one of those dudes. He's probably a year or two older than me now, but you look at these people that are like these inspirations he's basically one of the reasons why I'm talking to you now, you know, like how your life can, you make these certain decisions in your life because of what you see and what's happened to you.
Right.
And to get on the other side of whatever horrible shit that monster does to you is pretty fascinating, because you think about people that die. You mentioned Jack Knight. I talked about him on the last week's episode, where it's like, you know, some friends are like, man, I wish I would know how that feels to have that success and then think about wanting to kill yourself. But jeez, that doesn't that's how dark comedy is. That's how dark this business is. But that doesn't fill the hole. Whatever hole you're trying to fill, it doesn't have it. And I was watching a set that he did, a clip that he did on the that was from the Laugh Factory, where he was talking about how adulthood sucked and how he told his mother that he was depressed, and his mother essentially called him a pussy. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, and there it is. You know, hindsight is 20/20. But if you're having this success and you don't, you know, it doesn't fill the hole. And
And people who are hurting can be quite entertaining.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, so it's a thing that just that I think that's what just is never going to not fascinate me. But artistically, the way that he set that up, because it's almost like this thing is that something that just seems so unrelated can be so integral to the film, was just such a brilliant way to set that, to set this whole film up. I don't think you finished. I didn't let you finish on the spectacle that nobody shows up to.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's just from what we've been talking about. I think that's really interesting, right? Like he doesn't know anything but to perform.
Right.
Even if it's like a huge audience, if it's a small audience, he's going to perform this huge personality, this big time thing, even if it's like the kind of like sad desert Agua Dulce, like tiny little audience of white folks that are still interested in him and his attraction. I think that's really interesting. It's like a performer is going to perform or something like that's going on with that character.
I feel that way too. Yeah.
Yeah.
The spectacle in my comedy show. Oh man.
And even like the cruelty, like, right? Like what's this, the sacrifice that the horse is going to lose its life.
Yeah.
You know, and it's for this audience.
Right. Exactly. You know? No,
it's for this tiny audience.
Can you speak to also, I want to talk about the director and Antlers Holst, but before we get into that, can you speak to the geography of that place? Being a California gal.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because that kind of like those Western sets, you know, like those kinds of ranch sets that exist in the kinds of like other inland parts of Southern California. You know, I think about like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and the depiction of the Manson Ranch, which was an adaptation of like, you know, a former Western television Western ranch set piece. Setting. So I think that kind of setting a character like the kind of meeting of a flamboyant kind of charismatic performer like Jupiter, you know, like Ricky in that space alongside the really like workers of the industry, like OJ, who are doing the training, who are doing the stunts, like those. It's interesting because it's got some similarities in in geographical situating as something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, right? Mm-hmm. I thought the scenes where they go and stay with Angel were really interesting, right? Because then they go to Los Angeles and they're wearing his band t-shirts and stuff and staying with him. I thought those peaks of like the kind of way that the LA is close, even though it's like 2 or so hours afar, it's like so interrelated and interconnected into its relation to Los Angeles, right?
Right.
And even like at one point, Emerald says she's got a situation in Atwater, right? So she's got like someone that she might hook up with, I think, like a woman she might hook up with in Atwater is how I read that. It's kind of interesting, the dating life, like it wouldn't be able to find as much kind of dating or vibrancy in Agua Dulce. You'd get an audience like what Jupiter has, right?
You made me how far is Agua Dulce from LA?
I think it's like 2 hours. Let's see. I looked this up the other day.
Yeah. While you're looking that up, you just made me think about season 3 of Barry. Are you up on Barry?
Yeah.
So when
it's less than an hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is my man's name? His handler, his estranged handler.
Stephen Root.
Stephen Root's character.
The Raven.
Yeah.
Right. I don't remember.
Shit, hold on.
No, Harry. Hank, you got Sally.
Fuchs.
Fuchs
is like, he's in the middle of the desert and the
Mexican
cowboy saves him and everything, and they're out, and then he falls in love with the girl and everything.
God.
And he says he says something, and the girl is like, you know, we're just 30 minutes from LA. Like, he's trying to be like on some Dances with Wolves shit. And she's just like, you know, LA is just a half an hour away. Starbucks is like right across the highway or some shit, you know?
Right. The kind of way that they make it from Chechnya to this part of LA. It's like the kind of parallel they're making between this kind of exotic land of Eastern Europe to outskirts of Los Angeles.
Totally. I thought that was so funny. Yeah.
Yeah. It is a sworn.
It's
yet totally related.
Yeah. Cause that is interesting. Cause that's, I wanted to ask you about that. So you asked you about like the proximity of everything.
Yeah.
Anything on Fry's Electronics?
That was so wild, now, right? Those are gone. I mean, that was so weird. That was one of the weirdest things about the film was seeing like a vibrant, Fry's existing in space.
Nobody was in there. Nobody was in there in that store.
You know, it was interesting. They do have Barbie Ferreira, right? As a co-worker of Angel's for like a minute. I feel like there was maybe more that might have gotten cut.
Probably.
From her character.
He said the original cut, like the first cut, I forget what they call it. What do they call it? Like the master cut or something? Like, what do they call it when it's... He was saying it's like 3 hours and 45 minutes. And so she probably did have some stuff that was cut.
See, Chris, I want to see that version. I do.
I wouldn't mind it. Show us the peel cut. What did you... go ahead. The Fry's... No. Did you go there as a kid?
It was Best Buy, right? I mean, I think that Fry's... when that started? I remember if you wanted to buy circuits, I would go to Fry's. But like for consumer goods, it'd be more like Best Buy. You worked at Best. Wait, did you? Where did you?
I did. Yeah.
What did you think of? The appearance of Fry's.
I didn't. It looked like it was just like not many people there, but I was just thinking because it was like in the middle of nowhere where they were. But there's a lot of stores like that now anyway. Nobody hardly. I mean, it's different for me because I'm like near New York City, but like you think about like when you're on the outskirts, if you're like. You could be 90 minutes in, like 90 minutes, like away from the coast and or the Hudson River or whatever you call it. And it could just be like so different. It's like a different hell. If you drive 20 minutes north of where I'm at, it's a different area.
Right.
It looks so different. People dress different. They talk a little different.
Yeah.
That always fascinates me too. But this has been around.
The weather's different. I mean, it's really hot inland. It would be obviously really different kind of climate or, terrain to adapt to. I'm looking up that UFO Fry's and it is located in Burbank. Okay. I was unclear where it's located in the movie, but that would make some sense because it does seem like Angel lives in Los Angeles and has to commute out and it's like 50 minutes and he says, oh, you're really out here, right? So that would make some sense.
I got you doing some dramaturgical work. I wanted to move on to the director. What did you think of Antlers Holst? What did you think of his character having to get that shot?
I thought it was really
himself for his art.
Oh my God. For the art that no one was going to see, right? So it's like, what's the point? Like, it was not made for an audience. Is it art? I mean, that whole question, which I don't want to engage in. But what I really enjoyed was like the detail of like every time they call him, he's watching like animal attack footage. I thought that was a really interesting. I don't know. He seems to be just like the TMZ driver, like the TMZ.
Right.
Reporter, just this kind of symbol of like filmmaking and the history of moving image. It was interesting to me that he was as game as he was in that way, how it kind of develops that out. I don't know. What'd you think of him in the performance?
Yeah, I thought he was good. I mean, it was just what is his name? Michael Wincott. What else has he been in?
Alien Resurrection.
Okay.
Talk Radio. Born on the 4th of July. He's a veteran.
Yeah, he's like. a vet. Yeah.
Westworld. Bill.
Which I have not seen. 24. Miami Vice. It's been a lot of stuff. I thought he was good. I think it's just a play on, like, you know, this director getting this shot. And, you know, what do you think about, like the Scorpion? So was the Scorpion King their big score, like, for their company?
For the Haywoods.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seems like it. And it's, I was not remembering all the details of that. And it was maybe that, they didn't even end up using their horses, right? It was just like that they used camels instead, is what they said. But yeah, it seems like the appearance of Scorpion King hoodie and all those things in the film and the mention of it, you know, to me, that was just kind of, highlighting this kind of shift from, you know, the below the line workers into making them the stars of the film. That kind of intertextuality, that kind of like mention of other film titles is, of course, like, you know, aesthetic reference, but then also quite literal in the film. I don't know. I think that just solidifies some of these kinds of homage parts of it, but then just like this borrowing that is indicative of like Peele's directing style. I did want to talk about the most compelling kind of like human kind of part of like this kind of intellectual engagement with all these themes that Peele's doing is at the center is this relationship between a brother and a sister.
Yes.
And I really like that. Mm-hmm. Like I really, one of the most kind of touchy moments between Kaluuya and Palmer is like when they're like, "I told you this guy would bring a like, you know, non-electronic camera," and they're like slapping each other's hands about being able to get to this point. I love that moment.
Yeah.
That, you know, like the kind of like the ending gesture of like, "I see you, I recognize you," and that when the shit hits the fan, they're like really going to be, you know, support each other and be there for one another.
Yeah.
So I don't know, that was touching, you know, that the kind of stoic cowboy isn't doing this for like a damsel in distress or like a love interest, but for a sister, for family. Family,
yeah.
Yeah, which isn't so unheard of, you know, like that you think of John Wayne and like the Searchers who's doing this for like a daughter kind of symbol, a daughter figure or something.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like she's not being saved, right?
No.
And in fact, she's the one that like does the thing that ends the whole thing. She's victorious, even though he's on the horse at the end and symbolic of victory. Yeah. She's the one who gets the image and then also is able to like take down the alien. Right?
Yeah, because it killed their dad.
And the ambivalent relationship she has with the dad and like how she's like outside of it kind of engages with that kind of like how she finds a way to be herself outside of kind of patriarchal expectations that she, you know, she was promised that horse, right?
Yeah, Jean Jacket.
Mm-hmm. And she doesn't get it. In the end, she does because she gets the alien named Jean Jacket.
Yeah.
But she wasn't able to, you know, step into the role that OJ was able to step into, right?
Yeah.
One, because she's not going to be as hard a worker and has different skill set than he does. And two, because she's a woman, you know.
Yeah. And he probably didn't understand her being gay.
Mm-hmm.
The cowboy, you know, that, when you talk about that cowboy shit, it's different. I mean, that's something that's kind of unspoken too. But then she's probably who would have known back, you know, that her being that young probably wouldn't have known yet if she, I mean, she probably knew, but who knows if she came out. She's probably a kid when I forget how she looked in that flashback when
I don't think they show her. I think they show him only. Like I think it's from her perspective.
That's interesting into itself,
right?
Yeah.
It'd be from her perspective.
Right. And so you only see a younger version of OJ.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. And they just related together. Yeah. Go ahead.
she's the heart, right? She's the performer that like performs no matter what the audience is, if it's a tired film crew, but she's the performer. She's kind of, I don't know, her performance really carried it in a way that complements really well Daniel Kaluuya's, but is the most exciting part.
Right. Cause at the beginning he couldn't start until she came. So he couldn't, he was just like, my sister's coming.
Yeah. He couldn't even do it.
Yeah. So that, that's so, I don't know how that turned out, but it seemed like that was a big score for them.
Yeah. The Scorpion King.
Yeah. It's a big gig.
Yeah. That was like the early 2000s, which is interesting. I don't know if I have a sense of when the dad started the company.
It might have been with the grandfather.
Yeah.
But then back then, like they were making those big blockbusters, and that had to be, you know, that's the
Rock. I would imagine they'll precede that too, though, right? Like that's 2000s.
2002. So they probably would have in 2001, they were filming it.
Yeah.
So you think that they, if we just want to be nerds and accurate about it, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that I don't
Mummy.
Know.
You remember the Mummy and all the, like,
I do.
Yeah. So it's like, that would have been a big score. Go ahead.
I would hope that there'd be movies before that for the company.
Oh no, I'm sure that there would. There probably were.
That's what but I'm saying.
For some reason, the Scorpion King to me seemed like a big gig for them.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah.
Or maybe it was just like a big gig for that year. Who knows?
Or for OJ.
Yeah.
You know, think of that as like 20 years before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I have a sense of how old OJ is.
The older OJ or younger?
Younger.
Probably in his late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, maybe it was when he was a kid then that kind of.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's an interesting question. I haven't really thought about the placement of like that backstory, you know?
Yeah.
Because Kaluuya is 33.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, maybe it was just a big gig. Do you have any other thoughts on this?
Man, I'm going to rewatch it. That's all. It's like, fascinating.
I think I'm low-key want to see it today, but I think I'll just wait till I'll probably go see it tomorrow after work.
Yeah. And then we'll text each other about other little details that we find. So anyway, it's just like, it's exciting to have a film like this. Like I remember, you know, like last summer, Dune was pretty good. You know, like I enjoyed Dune.
Okay. Yeah.
For those of us that don't have, like, you know, the Marvel films to look forward to, like these kinds of big blockbuster films, like Everything, right. Everywhere, All at Once, this one, these are like films that, like, you know, I can kind of, you know, sink my teeth into and be really excited about, and they're huge and big blockbusters, and it's exciting.
Yeah, I was really excited to see this one. I like the Marvel stuff, but I've said a lot of times it seems like homework and you got to do it. I mean, I did the Thor review a couple of weeks ago and I love talking to it with people that know about it and having those conversations, but it's nothing like something that's like original and somebody swinging for the fences, you know? So,
yeah, I mean, I don't want to, I'm outside of it. I don't shit on Marvel at all. I just don't know it.
You're not going to Scorsese it.
No.
Yeah.
I just don't know it. And it's like, you know, I've got too many other things. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
To like invest like all that time. But, you know, for someone who isn't involved with that, it's exciting to have a film to look forward to like this.
Yeah. I mean, I really like this. 4 stars initially, for Letterboxd. Just the more I think about it, it's rare that you get something a big time flick like this that's going to make you really sit and ponder these things, want to do podcasts about it, searching YouTube for different insights and watching interviews. It's a really good film.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you have any other thoughts? And if you don't, give me something that you're excited about, like a new film or two that are coming out.
I know that there was all this Black Panther buzz.
Did you see the trailer?
I haven't seen the trailer yet. I'm going to.
It's fucking great.
that's one that I watch multiple times. Get Out and this, and you know, Black Panther, I watch multiple times. I watched the original Black Panther in or the first one in IMAX in Chicago at the Navy Pier. That was a journey.
I remember that.
That's what I guess I'm looking forward to. I'm trying to look at films that are on my watch list. I'm just kind of keeping my head down and watching a lot of film noir and really looking for Los Angeles and different films that I'm watching basically right now and updating. Gotcha. Los Angeles Plays Itself. So that's kind of where my head's at right now. I didn't see Neptune Frost. I did want to see that. That was that Afrofuturist Saul Williams movie. Saul Williams,
I remember you telling me about that.
Yeah, I still need to watch that. But other than that, yeah, mostly Los Angeles films. What about you? What do you got that you're looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to Resurrection, which is a film that stars Rebecca Hall. A woman's carefully constructed life is upended when an unwelcome shadow from her past returns, forcing her to confront the monster she's evaded for two decades.
Oh, wow.
I really like Rebecca Hall. I really loved her performance in Night House, which is what came out last year. I think it might be streaming somewhere now, but you can stream it. It's like a good, solid horror movie. Some actual funny moments in it too. I was impressed by. That I was not expecting.
Okay.
Very solid film. I don't know if I like the ending that much, but I like the ideas. I really loved her performance. So. Kind of just, and then I'm just looking forward to see her performance. And then this film, it's currently out right now. And you know, if you know my stand up, you know, I want to see this new Katie Holmes film, Alone Together.
She's doing it. Yes. A New York lockdown love story. Is it COVID? Is it a COVID?
Yeah,
one?
It's a COVID story. Yeah.
Huh. Directed by, that's exciting.
I think it's just going to be like one of those. It's going to be, I think it comes out on demand on the 29th. So it might be just one of those fun movies, like a rom-com that I could have an adult beverage, you know, and watch it and enjoy it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's two that I'm excited about. Obviously Black Panther in November, but.
Your mention of a Hall reminded me about Regina Hall's and Sterling K. Brown's Honk for Jesus.
Yes.
Save Your Soul, which I saw a trailer of in this.
When is it? Because they just released that trailer.
Yeah, and I know that that was the screening. Maybe it was Sundance. Anyway, I'm looking forward. I wanted to watch that. Yeah.
Oh, if this comes out on Peacock, I'm going to have to get Peacock.
There you go. It's going to put you on the thing for, and you'll watch Rutherford Falls too.
Yeah, and Bel Air. There's a lot of stuff on there that I want to see.
Yeah, I did binge part of that. It was just compelling. It was like
did you like it?
It's like a soap opera, right? Yeah, I enjoyed it because I was interested in the Los Angeles parts of it. Not too into it because I haven't like stopped after my binge mood.
You got me thinking about LA. What about Go?
Is Go LA?
Go is LA.
Swingers. Swingers. That was such an important one for me as a kid.
Really?
Yeah, embarrassingly so.
No. I love Swingers. I'm surprised that a woman.
I know. Likes it like that. I know. Sometimes we choose things that are not good for us.
Were they misogynistic?
Yeah, just as much as anything else, I suppose. It is sort of trying to criticize that, I guess, but you know.
I love that movie.
Yeah. Have you rewatched it?
Recently? Yeah, within the last couple of years. I do have it on, I got it on DVD. I think I have like two versions of it on DVD. I had it on video. I had the poster when I was in college. You know how they used to come to your school and they sell posters and stuff? And I was like,
I see that all the time.
Yeah. And
now they're doing more like art. I don't really see movie posters as much, but like, oh, here's this archival image or whatever.
Swingers was the shit. It is. It's a great film. I loved it. Doug Liman directed Swingers and Go.
Shit, is that true? Did he do Swingers? Yeah. Oh, he did do Swingers. Wow.
Yep.
I remember you're like one of the only people that I can talk to about the influence of the Ice Storm because Katie Holmes was in it. That's why. And yeah, that time, that period.
Definitely. Yeah, that's a New Canaan, Connecticut.
All right. We did it.
Veronica, this was great. Plug some stuff. You know, always a joy. I'm so glad that you were as excited to see this one as I was. And
definitely.
I'm glad we got to talk. So plug some stuff.
Oh, you know, if you want to find out what I'm up to, you can check veronicapedes.com. And if you have any LA films that you'd like to share with me that are in film noir or science fiction or social realism, I don't know, comment on Chris's Patreon for whatever episode and just flag it as a Los Angeles. Yeah.
All right. Well, Veronica, thank you so much, as always, for sharing your time. Everybody, thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Take it easy, everybody.